and most mornings came into the office with his head bowed. Sometimes the old man was recognized by other pedestrians or denizens of office buildings along the way. One of us, Philip Taubman, saw the figure frequently passing near the New York Times Washington Bureau, some doing double takes to see if it was really the man they had seen so often on television and newspaper front pages in years past. But he paid no attention to those who noticed him. Staring straight ahead, he looked, according to one observer who knew him and at once struggled to keep up with his fast, power-walking pace, like Ichabod Crane, hunched over, old and shaky, wearing a shabby trench coat with its belt hanging down. He was not only well into his 80s, he was depressed. More than anything else, he was tormented by trauma that had occurred nearly 3 decades earlier, by his failure to master the biggest challenge he had ever faced. Throughout his life, he had surmounted almost every challenge he had encountered, but not this one. It was the big heavy albatross around his neck, his second wife later recalled, and he couldn't get rid of it. It was suffocating him. It was killing him. In his last years, Robert S. McNamara was not the man the world knew at the height of his fame when he was U.S. Secretary of Defense and the dominant figure in the cabinets of Presidents John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson, nor the man who was president of the Ford Motor Company before being summoned to Washington in 1960 by Kennedy, nor he who led the World Bank from 1968 to 1981 after leaving the Pentagon. During those years, especially during his time at the Defense Department, he seemed brilliant but distant, cold and arrogant, a computer with legs, as Senator Barry Goldwater once dubbed him, a man who presided over much of the Vietnam War, in which some 58,000 Americans and millions of Vietnamese died. As early as 1965, McNamara had ceased to believe that that war could be won militarily, but he continued to manage the conflict as Johnson's principal wartime advisor rather than urging the president to exit it. He chose not to resign, with or without a howl of protest, and then mostly refused to talk about the war for nearly 2 decades afterward. Russell Baker, longtime columnist for the New York Times, saw McNamara at the zenith of his powers as an archetypical American figure, a leader in over his head who mesmerizes those around him, draws them into his orbit, then leads them to ruin. "People like this are not uncommon," Baker observed. "Their schoolhouse intellectual powers dazzle sensible people, disarming our normal, healthy instinct to be skeptical when faced with any product that's being sold too vigorously. We all marvel at the speed of their rise." Baker compared McNamara to the seemingly omniscient owl in a James Thurber fable who enchanted other animals only to lead them to slaughter when he fails to see a truck bearing down on them on a country road. "Thurber understood McNamara before there was a McNamara," Baker said. Baker may have overstated the case a bit, yet McNamara's mastery and commanding presence at the peak of his career were undeniable. But there was another side to McNamara, mostly unknown. He could be warm and emotional, especially with close friends. He was overwhelmingly powerful in defending his own views, but later condemned himself with equal fury for not welcoming more debate about them. His confidence and self-confidence before the war awed and intimidated his associates. But especially when first called to Washington, he was politically naive and felt insecure. He came across as incredibly intense, without revealing that much of that tension reflected the acute stress he himself was feeling. As Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr., his Kennedy administration colleague, put it more than 3 decades later, "I have known for a long time that underneath that disciplined exterior, McNamara is a man filled with tense and pent-up emotion, so wound up that in his later years he is almost out of control."